A very warm welcome to all of you to Ayurvedic Healing and Beyond podcast, and this is your host, Dr. Vignesh Devraj. In today's episode, we have a very inspiring guest, Dr. Dimple Jangda. She's an Ayurvedic health coach. Previously, she was an investment banker, then a journalist. And her story of how she became an Ayurvedic health coach is quite an inspiring story. And she has written a best-selling book, Heal Your Gut, Mind and Emotions, which I highly recommend. And you can find the link to buy this or through Amazon or through online portals in the show notes of this podcast. And do check her work called Prana by Dimple. And in today's episode, we also discuss various topics on what it takes to be a very successful and a good health coach and an Ayurvedic doctor or being a Vaidya. And also we discuss a little bit about what are the prerequisites of healing and what is the timeline that it takes to recover from certain diseases. And also what it takes to have a patient go through a remarkable recovery. And then we also discuss about her personal story, and also we understand what are the basics of science, like what connects the dots, what makes a difference between just because I couldn't find it in the laboratory doesn't mean it's not science. So we go in depth with about discussions on this. I hope you enjoy this episode. Now we go over to the podcast. Dr. Dimple, welcome to Ayurvedic Healing and Beyond podcast. So happy to have you.
Thank you for having me. It's an absolute pleasure for me as well.
Dimple, you know, when I read your story,
yeah,
you know, coming from an investment banking and also being a journalist, and now what you do is, you know, you're helping people, coaching them and making them understand what is Ayurveda, integrating that. What was your reason coming from an investment banker, journalist and being an Ayurvedic health coach?
It's been quite a journey, actually. I'm glad we're starting off with this question. You know, in fact, the first chapter in my book also talks about my personal journey. And I'm usually a very private person. I don't discuss my private life. But I was asked by the editor to share my journey, because otherwise people will not understand and believe why I had to leave a top-notch career in investment banking to take up a career in Ayurveda. So Ayurveda is not a career choice. It's a life choice for me. It started off as a CSR, corporate social responsibility, to give back to the society, because at the peak of my career, when I had everything, I was heading $550 million worth of transactions in New York City. I was heading some, you know, cross-border mergers and acquisition transactions in toll roads, hydropower projects, in a male-dominated industry, on Wall Street, rubbing shoulders with some of the most powerful people. And I had everything I ever wanted, you know, like good money and, you know, globetrotting lifestyle, business class, living in high-rise hotels, working in Chicago, living in New York, and, you know, trotting everywhere. At the peak of my career, I felt like, you know, that there was something missing in my life. You know, there was a vacuum. And I couldn't exactly explain what was happening. It was some kind of a existential crisis where I was trying to figure out who I am. What am I doing here? And what is the purpose or meaning of my existence? All of us have a reason and a purpose to exist. We need to just dig deeper and find that. So I took a sabbatical from my career in investment banking and returned to India. And it was an indefinite sabbatical to figure out what I wanted. And I spent 2 years traveling around the world while keeping India as a base. I went to 10 countries actually, in 11 months.
This was when... decade ago or
exactly a decade ago, I'd say. This was in 2015 when I came back to India, and I said, okay, let's, you know, figure out what I want to do and where I want to spend more time in. And I went to like 10 countries. I went to like Paris and Antwerp, Amsterdam, you know, Zurich, Istanbul at the peak of the, you know, civil unrest. I was in Bali, Singapore, Hong Kong, Dubai. I was trying to figure out what works for me. And then the 11th country I did was India. I started visiting the countryside, Tamil Nadu, Kerala, Karnataka, Rajasthan, Gujarat. And the more time I spent there, I started feeling unconditionally happy. You know, I was able to fill up that vacuum inside of me. I was able to feel happy. I was able to feel healthy. I slept really well. I ate really well. I was able to address my insomnia, which I had for almost 10, 11 years. I was able to address my massive appetite issues, you know, that I had. I couldn't eat food. Maybe I had undiagnosed anorexia as a child. I don't know. No, but I had massive health issues because I was not able to eat well. I was able to heal from all of those issues by just living in the countryside for a few weeks at a time. And I wanted to bottle this happiness and start selling it to the world, you know, because I'm a businesswoman. I understand the business sense of it, right? And the closest I could come to bottling that happiness was putting Ayurvedic herbs in a bottle because health and happiness is synonymous. If you're healthy, you're happy. If you're happy, you're healthy. So that's how the whole journey started. And I started the Ayurveda clinic about 6.5 years ago in 2017, November. Hired a team of Ayurvedic doctors, therapists, nutritionists, even biotech researchers. We kept, you know, like hiring different kinds of people, forensic science researchers also at one point in time. All permutations and combinations to marry Western science with Eastern sciences to see how we can arrive at a holistic approach to health.
Mm-hmm.
And my role was to be a health entrepreneur, you know, behind the scenes, funding the project, making sure that my doctors get paid on time, mm-hmm. you know, and everything went out of my pockets in the first 2 to 4 years because we didn't make any money. My job was primarily behind the scenes. But when I noticed that there was a gap between the doctors and patients,
mm-hmm.
that patients were coming to the clinic, doing free consultations that we were offering to them. We didn't charge a penny in the first year. And they would still walk away without taking the medicines.
Mm.
Without actually practicing what the doctors advised. And I was trying to understand what's going on here. So there was a huge gap between the doctors and patients.
You mean what the doctors prescribed and what the doctors advised, the patients were not taking it. Or they were not listening and following it.
Is that what you meant? They were not able to understand.
They were not able to understand.
They were not able to listen.
Mm.
So, you know, you see this in couples also, right? One couple is shouting, the other couple is also shouting. They're not able to listen and understand each other.
There was a communication gap.
Huge. And then I started addressing the communication gap. You know, just when the patient's about to leave the clinic, I would grab the patient, you know, politely saying that, can you give me a few minutes? You know, mm-hmm. I want to understand your feedback. Why do you not want to take the medicines?
Mm-hmm.
And the patients would say something like, I didn't understand the diagnosis.
Mm.
What do you mean I have a kapha prakriti, vata vikriti imbalance? I didn't understand. So then I said, okay. I started talking to the doctors and they started teaching me and training me in the process,
mm-hmm.
my doctors. I had about four doctors at that point in time, in fact, Dr. Rani, Dr. Namita, Dr. Vinodni, Dr. Radhakrishna Katha. They started explaining to me what they were explaining
to the patient.
To the patient, but they didn't have the time to sit and teach a patient.
Mm-hmm.
What they were saying. Okay, they have a 30-minute or a 40-minute consultation. They're able to diagnose the disease and prescribe the correct medicines, but they don't have the time to teach Ayurveda to the patient, and that's mm-hmm. short span of time. So I started explaining to the patients, what is Pancha Mahabhut?
Mm-hmm.
What are the three doshas? What is a prakriti? What is a vikriti? Why are they experiencing an imbalance? How do we address an imbalance? Why was this medicine given? I started explaining that. Patients started taking the medicines.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw good results. Patients started giving feedback that they were able to recover from this and that. Then after a few months, some of the patients came back with the same symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why have they come back?
Mm-hmm.
And then the doctor said, you know, medicine is of no use if the diet is wrong.
Mm.
They're still eating the wrong foods and they're back with the same symptoms, be it GERD or acidity or bloating or indigestion, constipation. Then we hired some nutritionists to address that issue. And we noticed there was a gap even with the way the nutritionists were approaching it and the Ayurvedic doctors were approaching it. So integrated modern nutrition is based on the concept of protein, carbs, vegetables, vitamin A, vitamin B, vitamin...
Micronutrients, K, yes.
Right? They have no understanding of prakriti, vikriti imbalances.
What gives acidity? What gives bloating?
What are the triggers?
Exactly.
What is a pungent food? What is a spicy food? Mm-hmm. What is a sweet, sour, salty? Why should a kapha eat bitter, astringent, pungent and not eat sweet, sour, salty? And why should a vata eat the exact opposite of a kapha?
Mm.
They had no understanding on that. So I started training the nutritionists also in the concept of Ayurveda.
Mm.
And I started writing diet charts for my patients from the understanding of the diagnosis and symptoms. And I must have written about 1,000 free diet charts in the first 2 years. COVID happened. I started teaching my patients what I learned from my doctors.
Mm.
In a way, I became the communication bridge between the doctors and the patients. That's where my role was, dumbing down complex concepts and explaining it to the patient in an easy, digestible form
mm.
so that they can apply it to their daily life and also take the concepts back home and practice it on a daily basis. So it shouldn't be like you get sick and then you go to a doctor to cure the sickness. Okay, that's curative healthcare. Ayurveda is primarily a preventive healthcare life science. But because of lack of time, we do not have the tools or the platform to teach preventive healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
Ayurveda should be practiced in every home. It should be a domestic practice where mothers, fathers, grandmothers, grandfathers, everyone is aware of the concepts of Ayurveda, of the concepts of food chemistry, viruddhahar, of the concept of dosha imbalances, dinacharya, ritucharya. These are concepts that should be practiced at home so that they can prevent sickness from the root cause. They can help the child recover from common ailments at home, a cold, a cough, a sinus or a fever. Of course, if it's a chronic infection, you need to run to the hospital. So then I realized there was a huge gap in the lifestyle itself and in the education itself. Mm-hmm. That's where I started studying more and researching more. And in the process, I ended up writing a thesis on Ayurveda for daily life,
mm-hmm.
not Ayurveda for disease care. Ayurveda for disease care is what you specialize in, what my doctor specialize in. But that huge gap that there was is Ayurveda for daily life. How can I practice Ayurveda on a daily basis right from the time I wake up?
Mm-hmm.
Oil pulling, gargling, tongue scraping, brushing with a bitter toothpaste
versus dinacharya, the concept.
Sweet tooth. Yeah. Little concepts like that. How can I detoxify at home? Can I do my own abhyangam? Can I do my own nasyam? Can I do my own ear pulling?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Introducing oils, karnapurana, as you call it. Can I do navel therapy at home?
Mm-hmm.
Can I do jalneti, which is a yoga therapy? Can I do pad abhyangam?
Mm-hmm.
Shiro abhyangam? These were concepts that were helping our patients living across the world, across different continents, repair the body at home without having to come to India.
Hmm.
At least the common health issues were addressed. For a major health issue, of course, they have to come down, stay at the clinic, stay at your retreat and do the treatments. So that's where my role started and it ended up becoming like a full-fledged thesis.
Hmm.
And I submitted my thesis, you know, to a couple of universities. I've submitted it to a medical university in Chennai. I'm waiting for my final PhD thesis. And I ended up getting 2 honorary doctorates from other universities for that. So I'm not a medical doctor. I am the gap or the bridge between the medical doctor and the patient.
Hmm.
And I hope that, you know, this by itself becomes a profession.
I totally understand. And what is happening, the ability of a patient to absorb and deconstruct the medical information today.
Yeah.
It's becoming a big challenge. And now I also see 2 worlds. One is people are overdosed with medical information and they don't know what is to be taken. At the same time, there are also information that if I use it and people cherry pick what is the best information that they like and they just follow it. And they think what else is not there is creating confusion. So I really appreciate what you have done, because when I see many of the Ayurvedic doctors, when they communicate, it becomes very filled with technical jargons. And that's where we miss the bus of helping people really understand and integrate Ayurveda into their life. So, Dimple, what was your challenge? Even though you were able to learn from the doctors, nutritionists, and you tried to, you know, capsule it in such a way that a common man in today's urban living population was able to integrate that. Even then, I'm sure you faced a lot of resistance. Because no matter what, at the end of the day, the key essence of, you know, new age living problem is they don't slow down.
Yeah.
So technically, at the end of the day, we tell them, just slow down. You know, that's the underlying fact. But slowing down in different aspects, mindful eating, go to sleep early and do everything mindful, slowly, and also have a schedule for things. This is the basics of the basic foundation of what we are trying to educate. But my question, what was the biggest challenge that you found and how did you crack that? I'm talking about when patients come, no, I can't sleep early. It's going to be a challenge. How can I go to sleep? And I love to eat out. How can I stop that? I mean, you tell them you have to eliminate this. I'm sure you found a lot of resistance. So how did you manage with that? And I'm sure without breaking that, those results wouldn't have come.
No. You know, there's a reason why we have such a high success rate in my clinic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like I was discussing, you know, we have a new challenge that there's a waiting period of 10 to 12 days for patients now to be able to see us. And of course, you know, we're trying to circumnavigate that situation. In the beginning, there were no patients in my clinic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like most of the patients, I mean, most of the doctors and clinics is just like that.
Yeah. So my doctors were sitting idle.
Mm.
I had 4 doctors in the beginning when I started out. And then there were permutations and combinations. You know, they had different schedules and all. For the first 1 year, it was a challenge to even bring the patient inside the clinic because their perception of Ayurveda was that it's slow, it's traditional. It has not been proven and validated by Western medicine.
Hmm.
That was the initial challenges. I went to the farmer's market where they sell organic vegetables and fruits. Okay. I begged the founder of the lady, Miss Kavita Mukhi, to give me a stall. She said, what will you do? I said, you give me a stall. So every Sunday, I would start at the farmer's market at 9 in the morning. And I would stay there till 3:30 in the afternoon, distributing pamphlets to anybody who was willing to listen to me. Right now, I'm sitting in this plush cabin and doing an interview with you where I'm able to communicate with maybe 10,000 plus people who are listening to the podcast. That wasn't the case when I started out. I would stand at the farmer's market, distribute a pamphlet, and I would ask the person, have you heard about Ayurveda? Can I tell you a little bit about Ayurveda? How does it work? In a day, I would probably talk to about 4 to 8 people or 10 people sometimes. If I got lucky, 12 people. No food break, no water break. You're talking continuously. And then one out of those 10 people would show up to the clinic saying, I was really convinced with what you said, and I really want to give this an honest attempt. Can you help me? Then I would take them to the doctor. The doctor would do the consult. And after the consult, I would bring them back to my cabin. I would explain and deconstruct everything that the doctor has said. That was the resistance I faced in the first 1 year. Why Ayurveda itself? Okay. Then the second year, we faced resistance in nutrition. Okay, I'll take the medicines, but I will not change my diet. Then I started teaching nutrition to the patient. Something as simple as, you know, fruits takes 3 hours in your body. Vegetables take 6 hours in your body. Grains and pulses takes 18 hours in your body. Meat, seafood, eggs takes about 72 hours in your body. Packaged foods, processed foods, if it can survive on the shelf for 6 months, it can survive in your gut also for 6 months. So it's right now sitting in your gut, the packet of chips that you've eaten 2 weeks ago. So are you okay with that? Then they would sit and think, no, I'm not okay with it. Then I would also ask them this simple question. You know, I would ask them questions from a perspective of psychology. You have to address the deep-rooted neurosis that is buried in their subconscious mind. Why are they behaving in such a manner? Why are they junk eating? Why are they emotional eating? Why is it a comfort eating habit? Why are they addicted to alcohol and cigarettes? You have to address the root cause. So I started counseling patients. Instead of doing a 30-minute diet consult, it would end up being a one-hour conversation where I would spend 30 minutes deconstructing their own psychology to them. The first challenge was deconstructing Ayurveda. The second challenge was deconstructing the patient's habits itself. Yesterday, in fact, I had a consult with a patient who was so passionate about his consultation with us that he sent literally a 2-page essay on his lifestyle, eating habits, hoping that we will find the problem area and say that this is a problem, that's why you got sick. And when I went through his notes, it was so perfect. His diet, his juicing, his fruits, his nuts, his vegetables, he was vegetarian. Everything was perfect. And I told him something. I said, no matter how expensive the medicine is, no matter how complex and advanced a diet plan that I give you, you will not recover. He said, why? I said, look at what you're drinking after eating a clean diet. You're drinking alcohol every day with a few cigarettes every day. If you're going to consume poison, how can I treat you? You're consuming poison.
And he's not aware of that.
He is well aware of it, but he didn't think it was important to address it. He said, I'm eating a clean diet. I'm juicing in the morning. I'm eating fruits and nuts. So on a whole day, he's eating clean.
That just cancels it out.
But why was he drinking in the night? He said, I'm going through a lot of stress. I said, so when you're stressed, are you going to drink poison? To suppress the stress? He's like, no. I said, that's exactly what you're doing. What's a synonym to alcohol? Poison. When you go to a bar, what do you ask a person? What's your choice of poison? That's what the bartender is asking you. So I said, you're drinking poison on a daily basis, hoping to suppress your pain. And you're coming to the doctor saying, give me a medicine to recover from the poison I'm drinking on a daily basis. How's it going to work? So it hit him hard, you know, that conversation. He said, I understand what you're saying. I said, you tell me, how healthy do you want to be? Do you want to be this healthy, this much healthy? You decide how much healthy you want to be. I'll give you a diet plan. And you decide how much of the diet plan you want to follow. If you follow 20% of the diet plan, you'll be 20% healthy. If you follow 100% of the diet plan, you'll be 100% healthy. So the decision is yours. Our job is just to give the diet. The minute you put the responsibility and the ball back in the patient's court, they become serious. Otherwise, what happens? The mentality is, doctors are God. They will fix me. I don't know how, but they will fix me. So we put the problem onto the doctor's lap. And, you know, my parents had that same mentality and attitude when I was growing up. Every time I was sick, I was in the hospital. They would run me to the hospital. Whatever the doctor said, they would pay up for it and rush me into a surgery. Like this, I ended up in surgery 4 times before I turned 18. We constantly put the burden of recovery on the doctor, which is not right. the burden of recovery should be equally shared responsibility between the doctor and patient, where the doctor is giving the right directions on where to go and the patient is giving 100% commitment and discipline that I will follow every word of what you said. No questions asked for 90 days.
Mm.
I will see results. If I don't see results, I will come back and question your methodology, your approach. But until then, at least give it an honest attempt. Another patient got back this morning, you know, saying that, you know, I've done the Panchakarma treatment, I've done the medicines, but, you know, psoriasis, it has lightened a little, but it hasn't fully gone. And I asked her, I said, how long have you had psoriasis?
Mm-hmm.
She said, few years. I said, how long have you taken the medicines? 15 days.
Mm-hmm.
How can you recover in 15 days from a disease that has been plaguing your body for 5 years? The rule with recovery is if the disease has been in your body for 5 years, you need at least 2.5 years to recover from the disease by correcting your diet and lifestyle and staying disciplined on that without a single cheat meal for 2.5 years.
Mm.
Only then you address the root cause of the disease and prevent a relapse.
Mm.
But if you're looking for immediate results, go ahead and take painkillers, steroids, antibiotics, suppress the symptoms. You'll not see anything on the surface, but the disease is still boiling inside of you.
Mm.
It's still growing. So you decide which one you want. She said, no, I want to address the root cause. I don't want to relapse. I said, if you don't want to relapse, you will stay put on this diet plan and the medication for at least 3 months, 6 months. You are seeing results, but you're looking for instant results, which will not happen. You want permanent results. You give a permanent commitment to this new lifestyle.
Mm.
You have to address the psychology of the client. The minute you address that, I assure you, the placebo effect is sometimes far more stronger than the medicine that the doctors administer.
Mm.
Because when the patient decides, I want to get better, nobody can stop that patient. But if the patient is not ready to change his or her habits, diet and lifestyle, no matter how expensive the medicine is that you've given, it will not show results.
It's absolutely true. I still remember some patients when they come and, you know, first question we ask, so, what are your health challenges? What are the health problems you're going through? Some patients would tell, you are the doctor, you should tell me. So I'm like, okay, then why did you come here? Unless you answer a few of my questions, how will I be able to know? And then the moment you know this, you know this patient is going to trouble you the most.
Yes, of course. We face those, you know. And let me tell you something, okay? I've had some amazing, pleasant experiences.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, you know, there's two sides, but...
Yeah, I've had some very pleasant experiences and we've had some unpleasant experiences also. You know, for example, one patient was like badgering the doctor nonstop, you know, heal me, heal me, heal me. And it went on for like 45 minutes and I was overhearing the conversation. Then finally, it was time for the patient to come for a diet consult with me. This is what I specialize in. Mm. I specialize in nutrition, preventive healthcare. I'm not a medical doctor. I specialize in food, in lifestyle, in psychology, in food chemistry. The minute he came to me and I went through his symptoms and I said, sir, you're drinking poison on a daily basis. He's like, what? Am I? I said, yes, look at this. Then I showed him where he was going wrong. I said, you're drinking poison here. You're drinking poison here. You're drinking poison here. He's like, oh, I said, how will the doctor heal you, sir? You're deliberately drinking poison. You're deliberately self-harming yourself. You're becoming self-destructive. And then he burst out into tears. He said, yeah, that's true.
Mm.
I am destroying myself because I'm unhappy with my life.
Mm.
I said, how can a doctor heal you? Unless you're willing to take that first step. So that's one, okay? That started off as an unpleasant experience, but ended well. And the patient then, you know, made a very big promise saying, I will change my life.
Mm.
Another case was like, you know, these young children who came to me.
Mm-hmm.
Those are probably my best memories, you know. This young boy, I've said this, you know, in a couple of interviews before also, because he was like something, he was something of a story that inspired me also. 13-year-old boy, his name was Indy. His mother, Stina, is from London and she contacted me and she had been my student for a while and I didn't know about it. She said, you know, my son has thyroid. He's 13 years old. He's also obese and he has other health issues, you know, severe health issues. Can you give me a diet? I said, can you put him on the call, please? You know, I'd like to talk to him directly. 13-year-old boy. I'm sure he can understand what I'm speaking.
Mm-hmm.
We had like a 45-minute talk maybe. And I kept giving him facts about the gut health.
Mm-hmm.
What aerated drinks does to the gut. It, you know, strips away the mucosa. What packaged foods does. It can survive in the gut also for a few months because of the preservatives. What, you know, unhealthy foods like uncooked meat and seafood does. You know, E. coli and a whole lot of diseases like cysticercosis and tapeworms and stuff like that. When I started giving him all of that information, that it was weakening his thyroid gland and hence it was making him slower. It was also giving him brain fog. He's not able to run on a soccer field. Mm-hmm. He's not able to compete with the other boys because of this. And I said, do you want to compete with them? Do you want to be class first? Do you want to do this, this, this? He's like, yes, yes, yes. I said, I'll give you a diet. You give it a try. And I forgot about that case, you know, mm-hmm. after the consult. Almost 9 or 10 months later, Stina got back in touch saying that not just him, the entire family changed their diet and lifestyle to support his recovery process. And within 9 to 10 months, his doctor took him off the thyroid medicine because he had fully healed. That was one case. Another young girl came, mother brought her. She was overweight, had massive fibroids, and she was barely 16 years old and having serious health issues with her period cycles. Mother brought her forcibly. She was whining and grumbling, you know, in the doctor's room saying, I don't know why we are here and all that. So I brought her in the front. I said, come, you and I will do a consult. And the mother was sitting in the background and I told her, you stay quiet. You don't be the one to give her advice because by default, children have a rebel attitude. We don't like what our parents say. So I said, you stay out of the picture for some time. Let me talk to her. I spoke to her, gave her the consult, finished. Forgot about the case. A month later, she walks into my cabin, takes the front row seat and sits with me saying, I'm ready for the follow-up consult. And I'm looking at her, I'm like, wait, who's this person? You know, because she was beyond recognition in 1 month. And I'm looking at the mother and I recognized and I said, what's the update? She lost 7-8 kgs in just 1 month. And her fibroids shrunk because she changed her diet and lifestyle. She was so obese that in 1 month she saw visible results. The thing with patients like this, if you give them a motivation, if you understand where it hurts, it's like a lion with a thorn in the flesh. The lion is roaring and roaring and crying. You can't give medicines to the lion to stop it from roaring. You have to address the pain point. Where is the thorn striking the flesh or eating into the flesh? Remove it. You know, it could be something as simple as, you know, I've seen women come to me repeatedly for consultation. To the point that second or third time, I actually asked them, do you like being sick? And she's like, what? I said, do you like being sick? You're coming back with the same symptoms again and again. And she got emotional and I said, are you doing it to get attention from someone? And she burst out crying and said, my husband doesn't pay me attention. My in-laws are troubling me. My children don't listen to me. I said, so you're creating diseases to escape those problems. Diseases have a psychosomatic origin. Now, this is not true for everyone. It's true for some people. So you have to address the root cause of that disease. You know, Ayurveda says that all diseases have a psychosomatic origin. But are we really addressing it? We need to go deeper than just a consultation, than just a diagnosis. And I think that's where having a holistic approach really helps. You know, if you can have an Ayurvedic doctor and you can have a naturopathy dietitian, you can have an integrated nutritionist, you can have a sports rehabilitation expert or a yoga teacher, okay? You can have a counseling, emotional counselor on board. We have all of those in our clinic. Then you can keep referring that patient to the right advisor or counselor till that patient heals. That's how holistic health should be. And I think a lot of hospitals now, in India at least, have understood, a lot of Western medicine practitioners have understood that we cannot have a one-sided approach to disease. It has to be holistic. And they have actually kept Ayurvedic treatment centers within their hospital.
I know many allopathic hospitals, they do that. Yeah. Even Apollo, they recently acquired an Ayurvedic firm and they have that.
Why are they doing that? Because they've realized the importance of digestive health, gut health, and cleansing the colon and doing a Panchakarma cleanse. I have a lot of allopathy doctors who are now sending their patients to us saying, the medicines will not show results unless we clean up their gut. Can you clean up their gut and send them back to us? Sure. And the patient is actually responding to the medicines much better the minute we clean up their system from inside. That's what Ayurveda does. It scrubs the body clean from inside versus outside. But that's a holistic approach that I think everybody should have. Marrying the best of both worlds.
You know, going back to one of your sayings about you had a patient with psoriasis and then it was there for 5 years and if you could do it for 2.5 years. But what I have seen in my practice, okay, 2.5 years will be like a solid challenge. But what I see is just by following it for just 90 days, you will see a remarkable changes already. But the problem is they expect this within 2-3 weeks.
Yeah.
But sometimes, you know, I have a advantage because I have the patient with me and I feed him what he has to eat.
Yeah.
And it's a big difference between treating a patient in outpatient and inpatient. Inpatient means you having complete control of them. So usually for outpatient, it's a little more challenging, which I see, because they are exposed to these triggers constantly. Mm-hmm. And what I explain to patients, 2.5 years, I'm sure if they do it for 2.5 years, it will become like completely reversible if they are really dedicated and following all the protocols. But just by following it for just 3 months, you start seeing a phenomenon. And that will give them motivation. Maybe I don't want to go back to that habits, and those triggers will not be triggers anymore. So I think somewhere people expect this to go away within a week or 2 weeks. So I think somewhere basics should be like 3 to 6 months.
I totally agree
with
that.
And that's where the real reversal happens.
In fact, you know, in my book, I've spoken about my journey with urticaria.
Mm.
You know, so I had multiple health issues as a child. You know, I had a cancer scare when I was 16 years old. I was in the hospital getting mammograms, needle biopsies done. I had 4 surgeries before I turned 18. I had epilepsy as a child. I had tonsillitis, deviated septum, fibrocystic benign tumors, migraines. And I had terrible appetite. And then I developed insomnia at the age of 24. Chronic insomnia, where I would sleep only 30 minutes a day.
Mm.
Okay. In 2020, January. Yeah. I went to Utsavama festival in Rajasthan.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a dry, arid climate during December month. Mm. It was very cold.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dry and arid. And I kept eating a lot of chilies, not realizing what it was going to do to my body. And I was having a lot of viruddhahara at that point in time because I didn't have knowledge of it. Suddenly, my skin broke and it felt like it was on fire and I didn't know what it was. By the time I reached Bombay, it took 48 hours via another city. My skin was so blistered that my doctor got a shock when she saw me.
Mm.
My in-house doctor. She said it's second, third degree urticaria. And it looked like, my skin looked like an acid attack victim skin. It was completely blistered. It turned black and blue. And it had swollen up. And she gave me the medication. She immediately put me on Panchakarma treatment, Takradhara, and, you know, the complete Yogbasti treatment to pull the poison out of my system. And I was on a series of medicines, Mahatiktakam Kashayam tablet and everything to pull the poison out. I was determined to get better because I knew that this was finally a test of my own belief and faith.
Mm.
I have such an unconditional, unshakable belief and faith in Ayurveda. I said, this is a true test to see if it really works.
Mm.
As a caution, my doctor also sent me, Ayurvedic Vaidya also sent me to a dermatologist. And now this dermatologist is the city's best, most famous dermatologist, who happens to also be a client of ours, who also does Panchakarma. When I went to her, she said, from the time you called me to the time you've come and visited me, your skin has improved a lot and the pain has reduced a lot. I will not give you steroids, neither injection nor oral steroids. Go back and do what you're actually doing right now. I said, I'm doing Panchakarma. She said, don't stop, go back. She said, I'll only give you topical steroid to apply when the pain is unbearable. Don't use it until then. She was an excellent doctor to give me that kind of an advice. You know, not too many dermatologists will give you that kind of advice. Dr. Aparna was next level. She sent me back to my own clinic. I came back to my clinic and maybe my placebo effect was strong. My doctor said it would take 6 months for me to recover from urticaria. And she said, there are
your patients, Ayurvedic doctor.
Ayurvedic doctor in my own clinic. Dr. Vinodni said, it'll take 6 months, madam. It's a very bad case. The skin has completely come out. And I said, okay, let's do what we can do best. And I couldn't even see patients for those few days. You know, it was such a bad situation where I couldn't smile. I couldn't blink.
Mm.
My skin had dried up. My eyelids had dried up. And if I sneezed, God forbid, my nose would be bleeding continuously because the nervous system had dried up here.
Mm.
So my face became like a dry autumn leaf and it was on fire. In 2 weeks, I'm not exaggerating, Takradhara, Abhyangam, Elekili, and Panchakarma treatment, Yogbasti, my skin started falling off like crystals. We could feel it come off. And the poison started coming out during my Yogbasti treatment. And I was given medication also, which was very strong. In 2 weeks, I had recovered. I had brand new skin like a baby. And even my doctors were shocked. Mm. They said, what would take 6 months? It happened in 2 weeks for you. This is because of your faith plus your disciplined approach to this. After that, I cheated a little bit with my diet.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, you know, I've become all right. I started having idli and dosa, fermented foods.
Mm.
The very next day, I started itching. Very next day, you know, within 30 minutes, I started itching. And I told the doctor, I'm itching. Is urticaria coming back? She said, no, you cheated on the diet.
Mm.
I said, that's true. So you can recover very, very quickly with Ayurveda.
But relapse can happen anytime.
But if you're not committed to your new way of life, your new lifestyle, then you'll keep bringing back old symptoms again and again. It's as simple as obesity. You can come into a Panchakarma treatment, lose 7-8 kgs. But if you go back to eating all the junk food that you were eating, you know, pizzas and burgers and French fries and McDonald's and, you know, Pizza Hut, you will become obese again.
Mm.
That's where we need to counsel the patient, saying that I will help you heal and recover. But you need to stay on this new lifestyle for the rest of your life, because you were heading on a track that was heading towards a crash. I've changed your track. Now your destination has changed forever.
Mm.
That's what new habits do. You have to also be able to counsel your patients to build new habits.
That's the challenging part.
That's where psychology plays a huge role.
Totally.
Counseling.
Yes, totally.
Positive motivation and finding their motivation.
Pain points, yes.
And giving it to them. And only an outsider can do that. A family member cannot do that sometimes. You know, you need an unbiased, honest opinion from a complete stranger.
Who's not emotionally invested. You know?
In your situation. And I've always sought opinions and advice from complete strangers.
Mm.
You know, and they somehow will give you the best advice because they speak from a perspective of an outsider. That helps.
Once, you know, even though I do agree that family members can, in fact, trigger you more when they give you advice. In fact, family members, even though they would be in their biggest problems, but they would give the most advice. But I know the story, but I don't know. But however, this sounds very true also. Father was a smoker. And his little girl comes and starts crying when he starts smoking and says, Daddy, I want you to be part of my graduation and my marriage. And I want you to be alive and healthy at that time. That's it. He quit smoking.
See, there was a strong motivation.
That pain point was stuck, you know. So I think these plays a very important role when it comes to helping people find that ticking point that can turn around there and say goodbye to that old unhealthy habits and say something yes to something new. And also, this is another thing that I've seen. You know, we have a saying, when you have an itchy skin, itching is the most pleasurable part. They forgot what it means to have a healthy skin. So many people, they don't have a benchmark of what it means to feel healthy in their memories, in their close memories. So they think this is their new normal. I have to live like this. There's no other way. Maybe continue with my immunosuppressants or steroids or painkillers. So, and they try their new diet. They try something new and they think it didn't work for the last 3 weeks. And why should it work anymore? So I didn't win the genetic lottery, so I continue like this. That's their inner script that they continue.
Yeah.
So unless, you know, we tell them the timeline is not 2-3 weeks, maybe more than 3 months, maybe it can even take up to 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Unless you're committed, don't expect, but it's rewarding. You know, that ability to set them up, because many times we set them up for failure. Instead, if we set them up, this is the basics. When you're able to follow these basics, healing is inevitable.
Yeah.
And that's the approach. And I think that's also where, when you talk about, I was able to bridge the gap of communication between the nutritionist, doctors, and the patients. I think this is the communication that is missing somewhere. And we are also not able to consciously help them decode and connect the bridges between how actually their habits, like you said, I'm sure most of the Ayurvedic doctors or even health coaches, nutritionists, they are filled with patients who come and tell, I do everything right, but I still, why am I unhealthy? But when you decode, they are hiding something underneath. There is no smoke without fire. I'm sure there is something that is contributing. Yeah. It's just that, you know, you haven't told me, but we will try to figure it out. It's not like, you know, God was racist and he told you should live with everything right, but you will have this problem. I'm sure something has happened.
Mm.
And in that area, I'm sure you also do that. Maybe we'll also discuss that. Questioning the patient is also a very important part. You know, helping them. Investigations. Like just the art of good conversation with the patient.
Yeah.
I'm sure you also understand sometimes when the communication is not poor, the patient doesn't want to communicate everything as well. So how do you deal with that? How do you help them extract some of their darker sides, which they do not want to
share?
But we know that is the cause for this, or that could have been the cause. So what are your steps to help a patient? First of all, you know, I'm sure you have to make them feel safe too. So how do you help them? It's okay, but let's go to the deeper sides.
We do face that quite often, okay, where the patient comes and says, I'm doing everything right, but I'm not getting better. And I tell them, listen, the law of the universe is same for all of us. The gravitational law is same for us. Input equals output is also same for us. What goes in is what is coming out. It is impossible that you're putting in healthy food and your body is generating diseases. So if you want me to help you, you tell me honestly where the problem is and I can address it. I had this young girl from Pune. Her mother and her came for the consult. They came for the daughter first. The daughter did the Panchakarma detox and, you know, and I gave her the complete diet plan and I even sat her down and gave her all the recipes. I told her what, you know, utensils to buy, you know, 5 basic utensils so that you can cook and how to cook and still be able to go to college, how to eat the same thing for lunch and dinner, you know, batch cooking, but not eat tamasic food the next day. That girl turned her life around. Okay. She felt impact. And the next month, I saw the mother in the clinic and I was like, where have I seen this lady? She said, you treated my daughter. I said, oh, lovely. She came, she did consult, she did her treatment, she became all right. Then she brings her son. Son is also doing. And in the meantime, the daughter gets back in touch with me and says, this is confidential between you and me. Don't tell my mother. But I have this one habit. I want to kick it. And I trust you. I was so happy. This young girl who's in her 20s comes up and tells me upfront that I have this habit. Can you help me kick it? You have to build that trust with that patient to the point that the patient trusts you and thinks that you can help. And when I gave the girl the remedy, I said, okay, you know, I'm so proud of you for coming up to me and telling me the truth. This stays between you and me. And this is what you can do. You know, these are some steam inhalation, These are some remedies and detoxification rituals that will help you forget your habits. You know, your vices. And the girl has kicked the habit because she wants to get better and she was able to trust me and she was able to build a relationship of faith and trust and camaraderie or friendship with me, saying that she's not just my health coach, she's also a good friend to me and I can trust her. Right? So that changed. Then when her brother came for the consult, you know, he had a different psychology. He was very sick with many, many health issues and that was leading to severe anxiety and even clinical depression at one point in time. And when I saw what he was eating, I was shocked. He was eating everything from outside. And he said he was addicted to all the junk foods only. He's like, I don't know how to eat healthy anymore. So then I trained the mother to hire a cook, train the chef, go to Pune, buy all the ingredients, set up the kitchen, set up the masala dabba. And he's like, oh, you know, my friends won't agree. I said, forget what your friends do. You pay for everyone. You get your cook. You eat clean and healthy. Looking at you, your friends will get inspired to eat clean, the ones you're living with. And he said, when I travel, there's nothing clean to eat. Everything is junk. I'm going to Bhopal. I said, impossible that you don't get healthy food in Bhopal. He said, yeah, but I have to go to McDonald's. I said, no. Who said you have to go to McDonald's? Is someone punishing you and forcing you to go to McDonald's? He's like, no. I said, then who is? I said, I'd rather you eat at a dhaba where the food is cooked and the cooked food is 100% hygienic than you eat a processed packaged burger from a McDonald's. God knows what is the shelf life of that. The minute I said to him that you have a choice and you are choosing the worst of the choices that's available, he understood that it was his responsibility and there was a shift in his mindset. Now we're still tracking his progress to see how much of his lifestyle he's changed. But I'm saying it's possible that patients can kick their habits.
Definitely.
When you give them a little support. You know, that's all they want. They want a little support. They want a listener. Sometimes they can go overboard, you know, with their complaints. They can go on and on ranting about their complaints, not realizing that there's a limited time period for a consultation. There you have to correct the patient and say, okay, stop complaining. Now let's start focusing on the solution, right? You can complain for 30 minutes, 60 minutes, all your life because you've been suffering all your life. Let's put all our energy on the solution and shall we discuss only solutions? And suddenly there's a shift in even the patient. They're like, yeah, okay, let's talk about the solution. And every time they bring the problem back saying, yeah, I tried this, but it never worked. I said, again, let's not talk about the problem. Let's talk about the solution. Let's make this work for you. You have to constantly bring them back. You know, they have derailed.
Totally, yes.
That's why they're sick. You need to bring them back on track with a lot of discipline, reminders, and kindness. And also tough love. Kindness is not enough. Tough love. I remember, yes, last week again, this client came to me saying she was struggling with weight issues and severe health issues, and she had a high-profile corporate job. And then I saw her diet, what she was already eating. There were almost like 4 to 6 cups of coffee and lots of sugary treats, which the office provides. It's an American company. And I looked at her, I said, this coffee has to go. And she gave me a smile. I said, I'm sorry, but I'm going to scold you now. She started smiling more. I said, see, the problem is when we were kids, our parents were able to reprimand us, scold us, and give us a tap on the knuckles saying that, stop, stop eating sugar. But now there's no one to tell us that. We've grown up into rogue adults where we do what we want and then we pay a heavy price later for suffering. That's what is happening. We've lost discipline and we've lost that tough love, someone who brings us back into place, a second mother. That's where doctors play a second parent in their story.
Absolutely.
Bringing them back.
That's a very profound way to look at it. And this is one thing I have seen. Some of the best doctors or health coaches or even the best nutritionists I've come across who are very successful, they have a knack to help people to get rid of their unhealthy habits. Their ability to communicate in a way, just like that little kid telling the father, I want you to be alive when you are there, when I graduate or when I'm getting married. You know, oh, that's very important for me. How can I get rid of that? So somewhere it is giving them a hope and an imagination. Imagine a life without that. How would that be? Imagine a life if you are not overweight. Imagine a life if you are able to sleep peacefully. Imagine a life where you are able to digest without these problems or having allergies. Oh, I never thought it is possible. You know, many people, many patients come with, it's like a last straw hope.
Yeah.
I think giving that ability to imagine without that, I think that's where most of the successful healers are, you know, their ability to direct their imagination. Let's just look slightly elsewhere. I think that's what your, you know, how your communication with the patient is helping.
You know, you're right about it. Okay. I think I've been blessed with my challenges and also with my exposure. When people ask me, why did I choose to become a health coach? I had my own personal health challenges. I had many medical challenges, okay? And how am I able to convince my clients to do the right thing? I had the exposure of living in many countries, like traveling in many countries and living in some. I had exposure to an international community growing up. Like, you know, I had friends from 20 different countries growing up. I also had exposure to people's motivations. You know, when I met people from different cultures and ethnicity, I would always ask, what is common between me and this person? You know, so I have some close French friends and I was like, what is common between them and me? There was a common pursuit of health and happiness. We all want to be healthy. We all want to be happy. There's not a single person in this world you'll meet who says, I want to be unhappy. I want to be unhealthy. There's a common positive motivation. In my case, also my background in journalism, television, my background in investment banking, understanding what corporate world feels like, understanding the temptations of the youth, you know, because I've also had friends who used to party a lot, drink a lot, smoke a lot. And I always was a vegetarian and a teetotaler. And I used to always be curious what makes them do this, right? Having been exposed to many cultures, many lifestyles, many careers, allows me to also empathize with what is going on in the other person's mind. So I constantly try to understand, how can I connect with this person? What is our common aspiration? Now, your aspiration is taking Ayurveda to the masses and taking it to the next level compared to what your father did. You know, your father built a foundation and a legacy for you. But instead of just being trapped in that legacy, you wanted to break some barriers and do that. So the first time when we sat down and spoke, I told you the barriers that I was breaking and the challenges I was facing of being in Ayurveda despite not having a medical degree. And you were able to empathize with that. And I was able to empathize with your journey. So you have to, when speaking with a person, look for that common point of aspiration or motivation. That is your connecting point. I have noticed or felt the success of connecting with people who don't speak the same language as me. I had an Ethiopian driver in California who was taking me around. He didn't speak much English. Of course, I didn't speak Ethiopian. But we ended up developing such a good bond simply because I asked him when I sat in the car that I'm going to order a sandwich. Can I order one for you? He was so touched by that. He's like, no one has ever offered me a sandwich. I was surprised. I said, in India, that's what we do. We don't eat without offering the other person, even if it's a complete stranger, saying, can I give you a bite? Even in a train, we have this habit of sharing meals, right? He was so touched by that he took me for a 2-hour tour around California in the evening at no extra cost. So we always have to look at how we can connect with that other person, find a common motivation and an aspiration, and then use that as a leverage to convince that person to listen to your advice. Helps.
Totally. I mean, even the word relationship, you know.
Yeah.
It comes from the word relate.
Yes. Okay.
What can I relate with this? How can I relate with this person? That's what relation. Yeah. I think that's what you're trying to explain.
I find that, you know, being a medical doctor like yourself and everybody else that I work with, it is a challenge because you meet a lot of people. Like my doctor's met 10,000 patients in her lifetime. She's lost count. She says, I don't remember people by their name or face, but the minute they tell me their symptoms, I remember them. Ah, you're that person with that symptom, I remember. I know it is challenging, but she connects with the patients through empathy that I understand you've been suffering. I want to help you. Even that one line works. Even if you don't have time to have a full-fledged conversation like the way we are having, even that one sentence, I know you've been suffering for a long time. Don't worry. We will do everything to help you. The minute you say that, you know, the emotions that comes out of that person on the other side is genuine and real.
That feeling of safety, you know, that's what is given.
That you're cared for. That someone is listening to you. That someone wants to help you. That's what people want, right? Even if that person sees a ray of hope, that person will do everything in his or her hands or power to reach out for that and find a way out. But you have to give them the ray of hope, that positive motivation, that don't worry, I am there. And that helps.
Totally. Even the word, even though some of the meanings of the word vaidya,
yeah,
you know, it's written, vidya is knowledge and vaidya is somebody who can give that knowledge and wisdom. But there's also another meaning of vaidya is to give that confidence, give that ray of hope and light that, okay, I understand you are in a space of darkness, but we can, let's hold hands and take step by step to uncover that. So I think giving that, even if some of the diseases are incurable, maybe not, I wouldn't use the word incurable because it's not technically right. Just because somebody didn't find a cure doesn't mean it is incurable. Maybe tomorrow it could become curable, but I'm deviating the topic. But the point of some diseases is very difficult. But just by being in a space of compassion and empathy itself is a huge healer there. And that can give a, that could give a recovery too, you know. And that's where many doctors who have a big heart and empathy has a huge, I mean, these doctors, you'll find it at home as a mother or as a, as your friend, or just like to that Ethiopian driver, you were a healer at that point of time because I care for you. We are together. You know, that sense itself is able to unlock many people's resistance and find, okay, I am counted. I am myself. You know, this is a way for me to also heal and open up.
You are mothering the patient.
Exactly.
Right? That's why I said, you know, doctors are like a second parent to the child, to the patient. The mother gave birth. The mother was able to nourish, nurture, and bring the child up to the age of 18, 20 in a very safe environment. But after that, the child or the adult now is on its own. And when they go on a wrong path for way too long with repeatedly abusing their body or having the same wrong habits or same wrong nutrition, they end up in the hospital seeking help. Now, the person who's helping is a doctor, but also a life giver. You know, that's why in India, we say doctors are gods because they bring life back into you. And hats off to them. You know, the front, you know, the frontline doctors who are in the first line of medical emergency and care. you know, emergency physicians, they bring life back. Their job is to bring life back. After that, it's your responsibility and to duty to take care of that gift that the doctor has given you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I tell patients, you know, you can go to a hospital for acute conditions, but when you come back, you have to address it so that there is no relapse by changing your diet and lifestyle. You have a responsibility and a duty towards this body. This body is not a gift for you to abuse. God has given you this body, your privileged class, that you have hands and legs at work. There are so many who are born with improper limbs, mm-hmm. or born with autoimmune disorders, or born with genetic disorders. What do you do for them? You can't do anything. You can give them hope. You can give them kindness and empathy and strength and immunity and nourishment. But you are a privileged class and you have a serious responsibility and duty towards your body.
Mm-hmm.
So don't take that lightly. And I guess, you know, if patients and doctors can come halfway,
mm-hmm.
that meeting point is golden. That's where healing is.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right, you know, for every disease there's a cure. For every problem, there is a solution. You know, for every disease or a discomfort in our body, there's a herb that can heal us. Our job is just to find it. We've not found it yet. But in such cases, at least we must continue giving that patient the motivation and the confidence and kindness and empathy. Keep going. We will find the path.
Mm-hmm.
We will find our way out of this maze, this chakravyuh.
Mm-hmm.
We will find our way out of it together. That motivation is a game changer.
Totally.
And that, I feel like, you know, is the biggest placebo mm-hmm. effect that you can give a patient, you know. People debate about it, saying that, oh, homeopathy is all placebo. Naturopathy, Ayurveda is probably placebo and a pseudoscience. Whatever you say, people are getting better from it, right? People are healing. People have been able to bid adieu to chronic diseases. I have recovered from urticaria. I was able to avoid my fifth surgery for fibrocystic benign tumors. My dad was able to avoid his gallbladder surgery by dissolving his gallbladder stone. So many of my patients were able to avoid deviated septum septoplasty surgery by just doing Nasium treatment,
mm-hmm.
right? People are getting better. I've seen clinical depression patients come out of clinical depression using just Shirodhara treatment and mild medicines,
mm-hmm.
nothing too strong. No antidepressants. They were not suppressing it. I am seeing miracles happen on a daily basis, but small miracles, big miracles at their own pace.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't shut down everything, you know, and in this area, a psychological factor plays a huge role in mm-hmm. helping these patients tide over bad times.
Mm-hmm.
There, I guess, you know, doctors, if they were equipped with the right counselors, this holistic science can go a long way.
I think every doctor, directly or indirectly, is a psychologist.
Mm.
And every health coach is also a psychiatrist or a psychologist, directly or indirectly. Because in a way, it's about making the person convince what is to be given up and what is to change.
Yeah.
Now, coming to that word placebo. So, I think somewhere we are also calling the word placebo as something we are not able to understand why it works or what is actually working. There is something inside the body. There is an inner intelligence that is making it work. Or some people call it self-limiting disease. Okay, it could be a self-limiting disease, but maybe we reduce the time. Something. Okay, psoriasis, whether you treat or not, maybe it comes and goes in many patients. But I've seen when patients do panchakarma, do certain dietary restrictions, the time that it used to take maybe 3 months, now it goes away within a week. Or maybe the frequency, it used to come during this severe, now it's very mild.
Mm.
So these kind of changes is where this is coming. And also the word, you know, what you spoke about pseudoscience. See, the word science is something that connects the cause and effect.
Yeah.
Science is the word that we use to connect. This is the cause and this is the effect. Like I always talk about what is confirmed bias. It's like my best friend, whenever India is playing cricket, he has to sit in one posture without going to toilet. And he thinks whenever he sits in that posture, in that space, India is winning. And so he's thinking that his bladder control is what is making Virat Kohli bat better. Now that is the confirmed bias that people are having. But however, what is coming to the point with science is we are restricting the science to our laboratory findings today.
Hmm.
Laboratory is limited. And laboratory is just scratching the surface of what mind-body is able to do. And laboratory is what? It's only about what can be analyzed with numerical numbers and quantified.
Yeah.
There are so many things in our body that is, we are yet to find equipments how to quantify beyond certain things.
Mm.
Our emotions. we are just scratching the surface how it can be quantified. Yes, we know how it interacts and influences our heart rate. But as you know, in your book also, you spoke about how high heart rate can influence many things, how cortisol, but we don't have the equipments to connect that. Yes, we can connect our heart rate. We can connect our heart rate variability. But there is no equipment that can tell what is your emotion inside you unless certain symptoms come out or unless you keep a poker face and you can still be angry, you know. But a lot of things, this ability to connect what is going on inside the body with your emotions and body, we don't have equipments to really, yes, we can do lie detectors and many things, but still it can be faked. So that is where whatever is used to heal beyond the physical side. And now what is happening is because our equipments in laboratory are not good enough to connect that. So whatever cannot be proved in a laboratory comes under the label of pseudoscience. So this is creating a huge problem. And then if the laboratory cannot, and you see fibromyalgia, you see patients, they come with all the blood reports, MRI. I don't know, everything looks normal, but still the pain is really there.
Yeah.
So why is the laboratory not able to find what is the real cause here?
Or leaky gut syndrome.
Yes. Okay, SIBO, another thing. We have some ways to understand. But there are Alzheimer's, dementia. It's very difficult to do a blood test and figure it out. Depression, it's very difficult. But we understand these things are there. Leaky gut syndrome, another issue. Now, in these situations, what is happening is because we don't have a laboratory or a lab where we can connect the cause and effect. So we have to put it under the pseudoscience. I think this is where the whole problem is coming. But let us not, and I don't call science as whatever is produced in laboratory need not be science. Laboratory is a medium to prove the cause and effect.
Hmm.
And science is what we call that is.
Hmm.
And if you can replicate this multiple people and you can put it in a peer-reviewed journal, okay, this is science.
It can also be manipulated.
It can, of course, many things can be manipulated. If you read this book, The Illusion of Evidence-Based Medicine.
Yeah.
You understand how some pharma companies hire the most expensive statisticians to bend that this tablet is better than the placebo group of randomized. By the way, that book is very hard. I highly recommend for people who find it difficult to fall asleep to read that. That will help them to sleep because it's quite hard data-driven. But it's a lot interesting. I hope everybody reads that will understand. Many of the conditions can be a mind-body issue today.
Mm.
Because we used, thanks to antibiotics, thanks to analgesics, thanks to emergency medicines, it has helped us to live longer than before. But today, the same approach cannot be used for these viruddhahara, by the way. And next step, I want to come to you about the viruddhahara.
Yeah. To add to what you just said, you know, that science connects cause and effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Science is an explanation about why it happened, how it happened.
Yes.
How did the universe come into existence? Science did not create the universe. Science is explaining what happened. So this is my way of explaining to patients, you know, when they ask me, how is it that I did not find an answer for this in Western medicine, but this is helping. Nature created humanity. Humanity created science to understand the miracles of nature. Science did not create nature,
mm-hmm.
right? Science is a byproduct of humanity, created by nature. So who's the real grandparent here? Nature. There are things that are beyond human perception, understanding. And here, science cannot answer all your questions. Tesla said it decades ago. Everything is energy. Tesla was a man of science. Albert Einstein was a man of science. But they all understood the concept of universe, energy, which is beyond explanation. Even Albert Einstein said, Stephen Hawking said, that science makes no sense without religion and religion makes no sense without science.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They understood that they were two separate forces, but they cohabitat.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Where science cannot explain. Meditation, chanting, gratitude, journaling. That is able to change your health.
Your moods.
Yeah. So someone emotions. Is going through anxiety, clinical depression. She's going through antidepressants over and over again, but it's not showing her results. But the minute she started journaling, meditating, expressing gratitude, which allowed her to vibrate at a vibrational frequency of 540 MHz, which is the highest frequency that we human beings can experience, she was able to come out of depression. Can science explain that? Maybe, maybe not, because only some part of it is quantifiable, that she was vibrating at 540 MHz.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of it, what expressing gratitude, what journaling, what meditation did to her mindset, can science quantify that? Maybe not. So we are humans, work in progress. Science is work in progress. What was true 5 years ago is not true anymore. Earth was flat before, then it became round. Now it is flatter on the poles. Okay. Back in the day, paracetamol was an over-the-counter drug. Everybody could take it safely. Now the same drug comes with a warning at the back that overconsumption can damage your liver. So what was safe before now is not safe anymore.
It's new findings.
So our findings have been constantly challenged. What are our findings? Scientific findings. Nature has not been challenged. Nature has remained the same. That's why sciences like Ayurveda, naturopathy, homeopathy, yoga, meditation, chanting, Unani, traditional Chinese medicine play a very powerful role here, because what they do is they take you back to your soul's energy, which is Mother Nature. Whether they're proven by modern science or not, that's a secondary question. And I'll explain why that is debatable.
I would like to just put one correction. Instead of using the word science, let's just use the current modern experiments.
That's a better way
of explaining. Because science is a word we give to what is the theory that has been proved.
Yeah.
Science is always there. I mean, but today our experimental analysis is not able to connect the dots.
That's exactly where we are struggling.
Exactly.
Now, Eastern sciences, we'll use the word science here. Eastern sciences like yoga, naturopathy, homeopathy, Unani, traditional Chinese medicine, and even the concept of meditation or kalaripayattu, taekwondo, karate, kung fu, they're all disciplined martial arts and other disciplined sciences. Mm-hmm. They're all sciences. They've existed for thousands of years. Ayurveda, 5,000 years. Maybe older, we don't know how to measure that anymore. When these sciences existed for 5,000 years, they were able to help our ancestors tide over good and bad times and combat diseases and survive. They survived, and thus we exist. We wouldn't exist if they didn't know how to exist, if they didn't know how to survive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their fertility rates were high. Their health was better. The immunity was better. The lifespan was better. Now it is debatable and questionable. You know, is it getting better or is it getting worse? When Western medicine or this experimental evidence-based laboratory science entered India and Asian countries, they did not seek validation and approval from Eastern sciences. Am I right? They did not. Western medicine, or rather experimental lab-based findings, is 200 years old at the max. Okay, that's the same time the chemical industries in Europe were being set up and pharmaceutical products were being produced, and they've been pushed in all the colonial countries, including India. And that's why the English Education Act was passed in 1848, where the government or the colonial rulers at that point in time gave funds only to sciences taught in English, that is Western medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they do not seek approval from Eastern sciences that have existed for 5,000 years. But suddenly, the power has shifted, and now Eastern sciences have to seek validation and approval from Western lab-based scientific findings for their existence.
Hmm.
So somewhere this lopsided approach is causing more harm to humanity than good.
Mm-hmm.
We have to respect that both sciences exist. Western medical science based on lab-based findings is great for acute conditions. It's great for emergency situations like fracture, heart attack, accidents. You have to run to an allopathy hospital. And Eastern sciences are great for chronic conditions, where Western medicine doesn't have an answer. So human beings should be allowed to have access to both sciences, rather than having a one-sided approach saying that only this science works, that science doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
If that can be shifted, that narrative can be shifted, I think we'd have lesser burden on healthcare taxes and healthcare funds in the countries, because we'd be shifting gear towards preventive healthcare life science, preventing a disease rather than waiting to get sick, which is always better.
Mm.
So I hope, you know, the narrative changes in a few years.
See, I collaborate with a lot of neurologists, the Western medical doctors. And when the doctor has a vision that my duty is not what medicine, what system, it's about how to heal the patient. When their focus is, okay, like, you know, before you said my vision is to put Ayurveda to the mass, but more than that, my vision is what are the systems and methods that will help heal a patient?
Yeah.
That's the vision. So whenever a doctor has that vision, what is the best method to heal this patient? Maybe if it's a worst case scenario, if it's like an infection that is very large, maybe antibiotics is a method right now to give that patient for a recovery or to prevent death. But in some cases, maybe giving an antibiotics will be the worst. Maybe there are so many other things that could be done. And I have many allopathic doctors tell that I don't want to give my son an antibiotics. And you know, you can't, okay, this could be an anecdotal experience.
Yeah.
But so many times when the doctors are invested in what is the right method to heal this patient rather than only my method is right.
Yeah.
These people are more open to understanding complementary systems like Ayurveda, even meditation. Even I know many allopathic doctors who now prescribe meditation, yoga nidra in their practices. So they are open to it because they realize there is a limitation to what you can prescribe in pills and just by counseling. There is much more to that. So I think future looks very bright.
You know, in Japan, mm-hmm. I love that country. Okay, mm-hmm. And I've spent some time there. And there's a reason why I'm drawn to that country. In Japan, when you go to a doctor for high blood pressure or cholesterol or hypertension, he would write a prescription saying 1 hour forest bathing for 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is forest bathing? Is it a pharmaceutical product?
Mm.
No.
No.
It means that the patient has been asked to walk in the forest. They have forested areas that is available to the civilians. You have to walk in the forest amongst trees every day for 1 hour. What is happening there? You know, the trees are communicating with the cells in your body. There's a communication that is happening. It's called pheromonal,
mm-hmm.
you know, information that's exchanged between the mother and a child and mother nature and human beings. Okay? It's just that. With the mother and child, there's a physical bond of feeding.
Mm-hmm.
With mother nature and human beings, there is a bond of feeding, but it's on the plate,
mm-hmm.
right? There is information being exchanged between mother nature and our human body.
Mm-hmm.
You sit next to a river stream, no matter what kind of a person you are, you could be an atheist, you can be a non-believer in, you know, natural sciences. Don't you feel calm when you sit next to a stream of water, a river?
Totally, yes.
Don't you feel calm when you go hiking and trekking? Of course, it's working. That's why I love sciences, you know, mm-hmm. that allows you to go back to nature. Any science that takes you back to nature is always the most powerful of sciences. And a lot of Western medicine doctors, I've noticed, you know, hats off to them. They're constantly evolving and growing. I've seen some of them, you know, come for my gut reset workshops. And a lot of them come to the clinic for their own panchakarma cleanse because they believe prevention is better than cure. Hats off to these doctors. Mm-hmm. They have taken off their blinders. They say that we have learned what we did in college, great. But we cannot stop with that. We have to keep evolving as doctors, as human beings. We have to be open to all kinds of perspectives and knowledges. When you believe that only your science works, you're like a horse with blinders. You only look forward and you don't want to accept that something exists here, something exists here. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. It does exist. It's just that you've chosen not to see it.
Mm-hmm.
There are some doctors who've taken off those blinders and they've said, well, meditation works. Yoga works. Anulom-vilom works. Breathing exercise works. Yoga nidra works. Pottery is working for someone who has, like, you know, nervousness.
Painting.
Pottery and painting is working. What do you like doing? Let's do more of that. You know, nutrition is working. Gut cleanse is working. Panchakarma is working. Traditional Chinese medicine is working. Acupressure, acupuncture, needle therapy. Everything is working. They have a holistic approach to health because their priority is not their pride and ego towards their sciences,
mm-hmm.
but rather the patient's well-being.
What works best for my patient, that's so.
That's a true doctor. And hats off to these doctors, you know. And I've had the privilege of meeting some of them mm-hmm. in my lifetime. They've given me some phenomenal advice, which changed my perspective towards my own body. And, you know, by God's grace, I've had an opportunity to become a health entrepreneur. And I have the opportunity to work with the likes of these doctors,
mm-hmm.
whose priority is the patient's well-being. Not money, mm-hmm. not power, not ego, not pride on which science is better than what.
Mm-hmm.
Those doctors are the true pillars of the society.
Mm-hmm. Coming back to that forest bathing, you know, we started a Sitaram in the mountains and we have a cottage called forest bathing huts.
Yeah.
Where you just engage with the trees and the forest. And by the way, about forest bathing, you just can't patent forest bathing because it's common for everyone to go there.
Yeah.
So, Dr. Dimple, what next for you? You know, investment banking and then journalism and now a very successful Ayurvedic health coach helping so many people, thousands of people through your online, also people coming to your centers and doing all this. Now, where do you see your vision taking you?
That's like a huge question. You know, it's like the elephant in the room that I need to address. I'm very grateful for this opportunity that I had to learn Ayurveda, which I don't think was ever part of my plan. Okay, it was never part of my bucket list. It was never part of my career graph. Nobody in my family practices Ayurveda. Nobody in my family is an Ayurvedic doctor. None of us have a medical degree. We're all entrepreneurs or business people, right? So I'm very grateful that I had this epiphany that I wanted to get into healthcare, preventive healthcare to be specific. Mm-hmm. I was not specifically looking for Ayurveda. I was looking for preventive healthcare sciences. What started as an experiment, as a CSR activity 6 years ago, it was supposed to be a small clinical practice just to help a small section of the population in Bombay city within the vicinity of 5 kilometers. Mm-hmm. That's all I was aiming for, helping people within a 5 kilometer radius. That blew up during COVID. I became an Ayurvedic health coach. I started teaching people through Ayurveda masterclasses on how to make it a daily lifestyle practice. That opened up the rest of the country. Then social media happened 2 years ago. The intention was just to share everything that I've learned on social media so that someone somewhere is benefiting from it. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't have access to me, even if they don't have the money or the logistics to come to India and meet us in person and do a consultation, doesn't matter. Learn from it. That opened up the entire global village. Mm-hmm. And I call it a village because I see followers from 129 countries on the podcast consuming content. I see about like more than 500,000 followers on social media.
By the way, your name of the podcast is The Gut Story, right?
So yes. I
would like to also inform that.
Yes, it's called A Gut Story by Dr. Dimple because it is a gutsy move that I made to get into Ayurveda. And I know a lot of people like me have stories to tell. So it's A Gut Story by Dr. Dimple. And the social media page is at Dr. Dimple Jangla or at Prana by Dimple. There are two pages. And in both pages, my team, they're, you know, unilateral or, you know, uniformed vision is to help deliver the information on preventive healthcare knowledge and sciences to the people so that they can make informed decisions. Mm-hmm. So education is going to be a huge part of my future decisions as well.
Mm.
Educating people, empowering people. And God willing, you know, if you're able to set up a bigger facility where, you know, people from around the world can come down, stay with us and do treatments, why not? You know, right now we have a clinic, you know, where people come, do treatments and they go back home. It's an OPD. That's also something that's in mind. I'm hoping, I know it's asking for a lot and I hope it's not a far-fetched dream when I say this. I wish and hope that governments around the world will get involved in this conversation on preventive healthcare rather than just curative healthcare. Right now, insurances are being set up around the world and governments have healthcare funds, but that fund is dedicated exclusively to curative healthcare. When you get sick and you end up in the hospital with, like, you know, serious diseases like cancer, the healthcare fund is utilized to help you. I hope that whatever you've set aside for curative healthcare life sciences, you set aside at least 10-20%, a small percentage of that fund towards preventive healthcare education.
Mm-hmm.
If we can teach in schools and colleges to children on how to maintain their mental health, their emotional health, their physical health, their nutrition, how to eat the right combinations of foods, you know, which is Viruddhahar, which I speak about in my book, how to prevent diseases, how to tap into your circadian rhythm, your energy clock, basic concepts on your digestive health, your gut health, your immunity. If we can start making preventive healthcare education mandatory in schools and colleges, we will be bringing forward a generation of healthy young people rather than a generation of sick people battling with anxiety, stress, and depression.
Mm.
That is a byproduct of an unhealthy body.
Mm-hmm.
Anxiety, depression just doesn't happen on its own. It happens because there's imbalances at a physical level. There's imbalances at an emotional level that is multiplying the effect on the mind. So I hope that this becomes like a conversation in schools and colleges, and governments around the world will get involved in this. And that's where we're hoping to, you know, direct more efforts towards education and empowerment.
That's a very noble vision to have.
A big one.
But also to remind you, you see, a healthy person is a very bad support for the economy. Because he will not need medicines, he will not need to go to the hospitals, and he won't eat unhealthy food.
Yeah.
It's not good for the economy.
No, I've written this line in my book also, you know, FMCG companies profit from your addiction to their foods, pharma profits from your disease, not from your health.
Hmm.
Let's put aside profit for a moment and put humanity forward.
Hmm.
For profit, companies, countries are selling weapons and initiating wars. For profit, we're feeding them unhealthy food, so they end up in the hospitals, undergo treatments. How far will you go for profit? How much money can you make in a lifetime? And how much money will you take with you when you leave this planet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for those who are in positions of power, you know, corporate leaders, I would like to ask them the same question. I know you need to make money to pay the bills, to pay the salaries, you know, to support your staff, to support the economy. You're doing a massive great deed. But can you also set aside a corporate social responsibility fund to take care of your employees' health, to take care of the health of those who are contributing to your company, your, you know, 5 kilo, 10 kilometer radius of people living next to your company, the villages that you're taking resources from? Are you supporting those people in those villages? Are you giving them clean water to drink, education? Are you giving them health care?
Mm-hmm.
If every company, every corporate honko who's in a position of power, influence, key opinion leaders, start stressing on the fact of social responsibility,
mm-hmm.
ikigai, a sense of purpose, we would have a much better, healthier, happier world to live in. And we would be giving our children a fair chance to survival and mm-hmm. health rather than them inheriting diseases and debt and whatnot from us. So do it for your future generation, not for yourself. That's what I would urge everyone to consider.
Really happy to have you in this discussion, Dimple. So it's a very noble vision. I really hope and pray that, you know, not just you, I mean, us together, and also all the like-minded people together, we, you know, as a tribe, we pursue our dreams on this for a healthier and happier planet.
Absolutely. We all need to come together and build an army towards this. Thank you for having me. It was such a pleasure.
So I'll definitely put in, you know, the link to your book and also to your podcast and your all the other handles in my show notes, so people can follow you and get to know more about you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dimple.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Ayurvedic Healing and Beyond.